Make sure there is no poo in the blue shoe. Push out your lips so that your mouth and your lips and your teeth are working.
I remember being the performer of the family, so if friends were over, my mum would be like, oh, Amanda can sing, and I would sing a song, or Amanda tells a funny joke, and I would get up there and tell a silly joke.
Something I've been trying to learn since I was a kid is how to whistle. I really, truly have tried. I got playground lessons and spent hours in my room on YouTube tutorials. I've put my tongue on the roof of my mouth, at my teeth, at the side of my mouth. I've looked like a complete fool. Because even when I try as an adult, I still sound like this. I do remember learning to swing and to ride a bike. Click my fingers, play hopscotch, yo-yo. But all of those things would be just a little bit better if I could soundtrack them with a carefree. A lot of the lessons we learn in childhood stay with us, like riding a bike, or if you're one of the talented ones, whistling. On this episode of All the Best, we're talking about the things we learned at a young age and what that means when you're grown up. In our first story, Anna Marino reflects on a life skill that she honed at the dinner table.
So it's a Saturday night and I'm sitting at a cramped dining table. And there's a glow of warm light from the candles that sit slightly tilted in the candle holder. And nobody seems to notice that the wax is dripping down onto the good tablecloth. I'm the youngest, and that means that I have to sit on the corner of the table, right where the leg is. I can't pull my chair in properly because the leg's in the way. And Mum's talking, so I have to kind of lean forward to hear what she's saying. She's talking about the GST. It's not usually something I'd expect her to be an expert in, but it's 1994 and there's an election coming up and it's a hot topic for dinner party conversation. Mum announces, nobody wants the GST. My dad, being a scientist, rolls his eyes and he says, oh, Christine, what you've got to understand is that 48% of people wanted it. Mum's arguments were often based on passion than actual fact. So she has a pretty cheeky smile on her face at this point. She rolls her eyes at Dad and she knows she's not going to win this argument. So she distracts people and she goes over to the fridge. She picks out the tiramisu and they all ooh and ah over the tiramisu. I don't say much. I'm only 10. But I'm really quite happy to sit there and still feel part of the conversation. To this day, Mum still remembers those dinner parties and the spirited debates.
It wasn't expected to be a confrontational thing. It was just an expression of ideas and just the drama of the whole business of just chatting to each other. And if the other person didn't agree, that was even better because it was all part of the fun of the thing.
Mum always had this sense of performance. She's always off to rehearsals for a dance group or a local theatre group. One of my favourite photos of Mum was when she was about 20 and she played this character called Jocasta. It's in the Greek tragedy Oedipus Rex. And so she's standing on stage looking out to the audience and she's got this terror in her eyes and her face is so expressive at that point. And I love how expressive her face can be. When my sister and I were kids, Mum used to instill this sense of performance in us as well. She thought it was really important that we spoke clearly, and she hated it when we mumbled. So, as part of growing up, It was really normal in our house to have to practice tongue twisters. The one that we giggled at most was,
"Make sure there is no poo in the blue shoe." And push out your lips so that your mouth and your lips and your teeth are working. That's how it's supposed to go.
Imagine trying to say poo without giggling when you're 12. I remember being at the dinner table when I was about 16. Mum was helping me debrief an argument that I'd had with my girlfriends. So I'm sitting there telling Mum about my day and about my best friend who'd had this sleepover and she hadn't invited me. I was gutted. And so I lashed back at her and I said something that I shouldn't have. And we had this fight and that lasted for weeks. So I remember sitting there, tears streaming down my face with this chocolate biscuit, taking a bite and trying to swallow it, even though I had this huge lump in my throat from the tears. And Mum would sit there and she'd listen for hours, like really listen, because she deeply cared about, you know, what was happening and she wanted to help me. And I often wanted her just to side with me and to say that the other girl was a mole for saying what she said. But she didn't. What she did instead was help me to see the other side of the story.
I've always thought that it's important to know and to think more deeply about other people's motivations for what they do, to talk to you about why Mary said something horrible to you and talk to you about why she might have said something horrible to you and to depersonalize it so that it's not you, it's a thing that's going on in her life rather than in your life. And I know I've always done that.
Now that I'm an adult, I come across people who, you know, really hurt me sometimes or make me angry. But when they do, I'm able to sit back and think, well, what was happening in their lives when they just said that to me? What's going on for them? How did I come across? How did I contribute to that part of the conversation? So it helps me to remove myself from the heat of the moment and think about why it might have happened. And I try and give them the benefit of the doubt. I've definitely learnt that from my mum. I remember enjoying listening in on conversations as I was growing up around the dinner table. But Mum says that I didn't really necessarily contribute.
When you were growing up, you were quite quiet. You were bubbly and you were sort of cheeky and you were outgoing, but tended to sit back and let the others, because they were older, hold forth.
I'm 34, and on this particular occasion, I'm getting ready to meet my friends for a drink after work. I'm finishing up and I'm tidying my desk, and I'm thinking to myself, I really don't want to go. I'd much rather go home and sit on the couch and watch TV. But I push myself to go. And I sit next to a friend of mine, and we start to chat. And during our conversation, I find that I lose track of time. And I forget that I was even worried about coming out in the first place. And that's what I love about conversation, is losing track of time and just being so immersed in someone else's thoughts and asking questions. As I'm walking back to my car, I'm feeling really different. I'm feeling really energetic and optimistic. Yes, Ellie?
Mommy?
Yes, Ellie?
Mommy?
Yes, Ellie?
Mommy?
Yes, Ellie?
Mommy?
Mom. Even at 2 years old, my daughter can communicate what she needs. And I find that she doesn't even need to use words necessarily.
Oh.
What?
Oh.
In here?
Oh.
something up here.
Yeah.
What would you like?
Ooh.
The cake?
Yeah.
How did you know the cake was up there?
I'm amazed by the simple conversations that she has with me. And I'd say she could only verbalise maybe 60 words. But even so, she seems to understand pretty much everything that I'm saying. And what's more, I can understand what she's saying. It's incredible.
Hey, Mum. I realised that you taught me the skill of conversation, and you did it through role modelling, by asking really great questions and always listening. Getting lost in conversation is one of my favourite things, and you gave me that. And I really appreciate it.
Oh, that's so nice. So nice to think that that had an effect on you as a growing child sort of thing. Oh.
So, yeah, I'm determined to pass it on to my daughter, and I know I won't always get it right, but I'll do my best.
That story was by Anna Marino, and the supervising producer was Alison Chan. Special thanks to Gabrielle and Dolfito and Edge Radio in Hobart for their production assistance. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. All the Best is a show for new and emerging audio documentary makers to pitch, produce, and learn. And teach me how to whistle, if you know how. If you pitch an awesome story idea to us, we'll also pair you with a supervising producer. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. In our next story, we take a lesson in kindness. We'll hear two people's motivation for what they see as being kind, including perhaps the potential downside. We first hear from Amanda.
My name is Amanda. I remember being taught that being kind and being a good person, smiling, making people laugh was really important. That was drummed into me at a really young age, I think. I remember being the performer of the family. So if friends were over, my mum would be like, oh, Amanda can sing. And I would sing a song, or Amanda tells a funny joke, and I would get up there and tell a silly joke. And it made me feel good because I made people laugh and made people smile. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, I'm a good person, you know. And I think through that process, I became really good at anticipating the needs and wants of other people. I thought of myself back then as a really good chameleon, like I could wear many hats and be multiple people. You know, I would be one way with one person and one way with someone else, because depending on what that person expected or needed from me, I would become that for them. To me, being altruistic, so being kind, meant I'm a good person and I'm worthy. If I didn't put others first in every interaction that I had, I'd done something wrong. And so I became really hypercritical of myself. And that's where I felt like it became a negative for me, this idea of altruism and kindness towards others. It's just exhausting. Like, when you're constantly acting on the needs of other people, you're not looking after yourself. You're actually really neglecting yourself. That kind of thinking really manifested in a lot of relationships that I had with men. I was always putting the needs of men ahead of my own, and I would often get into situations where I would like lose myself in those relationships. I would self-identify with them and their needs, and my needs would just not even exist. You know, I've done a lot of work to get to this point, but looking back, I was really ashamed and I was really embarrassed that I had been in relationships where I'd let someone cheat on me, and I stayed with that person for, you know, 2 years, and they had multiple fears, and I would let guys hypersexualize me, and I would just be, you know, the porn star girlfriend, and I'd be fun and sassy and do all those kind of, you know, naughty things that other girlfriends that they might have had in the past would never do. I didn't have any boundaries, and I always came out of those interactions with men feeling used and angry towards them, feeling like I'm the victim of something. I don't think I ever asked myself when I started dating someone, do I like this person? It was always like, he's cute or he's nice and will he like me? Does he like me? I was constantly kind of shifting and changing myself to become something that then they would like me. Yes. I think the turning point from realizing that I'd probably confused the nature of autism and I was neglecting myself, it kind of resulted in unhappiness. So I had two personalities. Public Amanda was always on, like happy, confident. You wouldn't guess that there was anything wrong. The private Amanda, when Amanda was by herself, she would be depressed. She would self-medicate with alcohol, cigarettes, dysfunctional relationships, men, you name it. Food was a big one too. I got to a point where I was actually physically unwell. I was depressed, yes, but I had physical issues like pain, and with the alcohol and the food and the drinking and all that kind of stuff, it had created chronic inflammation in my body. It's actually starting to manifest in a really physical form. And because the pain was so strong and so constant and systemic, I noticed it. And I could have just stayed that way, because it is easier just to stay with what you know. But I made a decision like that. I'm done. Like, I want to actually live and enjoy life. So I had to really dig deep and find the energy when I didn't have energy to really, yeah, take care of myself and nurture myself. Yeah, that journey was really interesting. It started with an introduction to a Buddhist practice, and the philosophy that I was learning at the time said that autism is all about, you have to take care of yourself first before you can take care of other people. And that was a really foreign notion for me. I was like, what do you mean? Like, kindness is giving. I think just that slight change might help people understand, yeah, how kindness to yourself can benefit. And to me, self-love is the same as self-kindness. It's start being kind to yourself before you be kind to others. Otherwise, you'll fall into that imbalance of thinking that you're not good enough or you're not a happy person unless you give of yourself to everybody else and neglect yourself.
Nicole is a 24-year-old Sydneysider and has volunteered in Kenya twice in the last 4 years. She tells us about her experiences and how they helped her understand gratitude and joy in the simple things.
I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do after school, but I always knew that I wanted to go to Africa. I hope it doesn't sound contrived, but I have the most vivid memory of seeing Cat Stevens. Actually, that was one of his first Yusuf Islam tours with my parents. And I was in high school and I had intentions of going to Kenya and Ethiopia the following year. And when I was watching him, I thought, you're such a humanitarian, you're such a giver, you're talking about all of these beautiful things, I'm sitting here crying. All of a sudden, I was like, I have to do something right now. I literally have to do something tomorrow. And even though it was so stupid and a lot of teachers actually got angry at me, I decided to go on a fast and basically tell everyone that I'm not going to eat until I make $300 to give to this particular charity.
As soon as Nicole finished high school, she was on a plane to Kenya.
I flew into Nairobi, which is very bustly, very vibrant, you know, beautiful in its own way. And the charity is about an hour's drive from another town called Naivasha, which is famous for bird sightings and the lake with the hippos, and it's so beautiful there. But where I was for the 3 months predominantly is a place called Gilgil, which is actually an ex-military base. It's a rural town, but there are buildings, you know, there's like two huge streets with various shops. I loved it because you have to sort of follow suit. You've got to buy your fruit and buy your bread and buy your coffee where they do and live at the pace that everyone else is living and take the matatus and their versions of taxis, and it's just so diverse.
The charity Nicole volunteered with was a not-for-profit organisation set up for kids ranging from 6 months to 24 years old. Most were left homeless after the general election in 2007.
So they were sleeping on pretty much the ground. You know, it was an unpainted, crappy, cold, graffitied building with a dirt patch and a playground on the dirt patch. So I think we were all a little bit shocked. I did feel discomfort, I won't lie, at the idea of having to pretty much make friendships with these kids 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, not knowing where to start and knowing that the teachers kind of assumed that we knew what we were doing and we felt quite lost. So we did feel, I think, all a sense of homesickness or being really out of our element and a little bit scared, but it's nuts, you know, 3 days in and you feel at home. They had some ridiculously awful stories of being drugged or having their arms cut off by their parents or being prostituted or walking 25Ks to try and get the hell away from whoever they were trying to get away from. And it was just so, you know, without sounding cheesy, just amazing to see them so grateful. And as a Westerner, as one of three Westerners that was there, it was just really nice to be able to bond with them and allow them to move away from those original reasons why they were in this charity in the first place and just treat them normally.
So she decided to teach them about a topic she knows a lot about, art.
My idea was to make art that they could keep. So we also did a lot of bead workshops. It was amazing seeing all of these kids with fishing wire coming out of their mouth because that's what the bracelets are made of. And they would just plant themselves next to the football field or inside the playground or in one of the classrooms and just bead. They were obsessed with it. And that was wonderful.
I was curious to know what Nicole learned about Kenya and herself and what drew her back a second time.
If anyone's been to Kenya, you'll understand that everyone runs approximately 1 hour to 3 hours late all the time. So I definitely learned the virtues of patience and understanding. And I also learned that it's really good, as cheesy as it sounds, to throw yourself in the deep end. I did a lot of things that made me feel increasingly uncomfortable and be laughed at. For example, I've never been a good bike rider. I had only gotten there a week before, and some of the boys insisted that I get on this bike. And within a second, not only did I fall off the bike, but the bike fell on me because I rolled into a ditch and it hurt so much. But just making a fool of myself in that moment, they laughed at me. They weren't laughing with me. I was a joke. I was being laughed at, but it was a bonding kind of thing. So it's definitely accelerated my innate desires to always give people more time and be more patient and be more understanding, regardless of what age, what race, what sex, what abilities they are. There is something that's so gratifying about being kind. I love being generous. It's almost addictive, but then you have to be careful because sometimes that obsession to be the one that says, "Don't worry, I'll get it," or this or that, in turn makes me feel like I'm kind of being walked over occasionally. There are other times where it sounds like a stupid example, but because I don't have the biggest backbone, I had intentions to get a tattoo once and the artist sort of wanted to take direction over me. And at the time, I sort of forgot that it would be on my body permanently. And now I have a tattoo that I moderately regret, you know, and that's for life. But, you know, at the same time, I would way prefer to feel regret than indecision. I've always stood by that. I'm someone who would just do something with a second of thought, you know, compared to umming and ahhing for a year, because the whole mantra, life is short, and I like to know what it feels like. I honestly miss Kenya every single day. The silliest things will remind me of it, like those big cooking pots or the colour of dirt or Puma shoes. So many different things remind me of it, and I miss it insanely.
That story was by Tina Matalov, and the supervising producer was Alison Chan. This episode of All the Best was compiled by Alina Godwin with Sarah O'Malley. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. And for the past year, I've been saying that the Victorian Stay Coordinator is Beck Fari. Beck first started with All the Best in 2014, and this is her last week as Victorian Stay Coordinator. So many contributors have been mentored and inspired by Beck and her amazing work. So we wish Beck the best of luck while we quietly grieve. Thank you for your love and passion for All the Best. We are so lucky to have had you on the team. Our community coordinator remains Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN community coordinator, Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed the theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe to us on your podcast app. And hey, maybe share it with the kids.